Honourable members, good morning. We're going to start. First, we have a long agenda, and the our officials from SARS and Treasury still have other appointments too. Welcome to this meeting of the Select Committee for Finance. It will be the last meeting of this committee for the year 2012, if everything goes well, and we still have reports to table in the National Council of Provinces in the setting. You have an agenda. I declare this meeting open. There are members on their way. Still attending a class to join us in this meeting. I received apologies from Honorable Makubela. He's got a doctor's appointment. I received apologies from the Minister and Deputy Minister of Kokta that they are participating in a strategic plan of the PC on Kokta in Franschhoek. I received a written apology, from the MEC for Local Government and Traditional Affairs in the Northwest Province, Sebegu. He also phoned me, and then I requested if he can't be here that he sent an apology. They are engaged in meetings with the Demarcation Board. Demarcation Board is touring through the country to take submissions regarding redemarcating municipalities. I received a written apology, and he phoned me from the Commissioner of SARS, Mr. Opa Magashule. So that is the apologies. I received no other apologies. So if members are not in attendance, then they're absent without an apology. I put the apologies to the committee. Mashile. Thank you very much. Welcome to the gentleman just arriving. He will be attending on behalf of Minister Baloyi. Can you please introduce yourself? We don't know you. What is your position? Special advisor to the minister. Can someone please notify the technical people? The sound is not coming through when the green light goes on. It's like in the studio at the SABC. If you haven't got the red light, you're not on air. Yes, sir.
My name is Don Tienise. I'm sending in for NBC for Local Government and Traditional Affairs, NBC Studio. I'm head of office of the Chief of Staff.
Chief of Staff. Yes, the gentleman next to you.
My name is Chris Molefe. I'm here delegated by MEC, Louisa Marvis, MEC for Finance in the Northwest Province. I'm Chief of Staff in the
So the official's role will be just to take notes, because you have got no mandate to participate in any decision. We take note of that, because I told the MEC for Local Government in the Northwest, listening to him about his apology, that they send the MEC for Finance. But I didn't receive a written apology from, or the secretary from, the MEC for Finance in the Northwest Province. I just want to put that on the gentlemen, you are all welcome. We've got the agenda in front of us. We will now take the briefing on the tax administration bill. I just want to sensitize members. We had a informal briefing, if I'm correct, on the 20th of September. If my mind serves me well, that, but it's quite a while ago. There were a few changes made to the bill, and we welcome Mr. Frans Tomacek and his team here again to take us through the briefing. I want to put it to the committee that you asked the following questions at the previous briefing, that you noticed, and as well as the presenters. And I'll put it slowly. The committee wanted to know why staff from the Ombudsman office will be seconded from SARS, as there were suitable, qualified, and experienced candidates elsewhere. That was the first question. The second one is the committee wanted to know at what levels and categories the seconded staff will be from. Three, that the office of the Ombudsman should be protected in terms of its budget and funding. Four, what will happen if suspicious activity is at a private residence, as the bill only proposes search and seizure at the business premises? If SARS was hoping for the legislation to be passed this year, well, I think yes, the committee wanted to know what was meant by a senior SARS official. And lastly, we sought further clarity on the office of the Ombudsman and if it complied with international best practices. So there's the questions that were asked. I'll table the questions so Mr. Tomacek can also incorporate that in his briefing. Welcome, sir. Over to you to take us through the bill.
Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said that he likes paying tax because with tax you buy civilization. So I think that encapsulates it in a very short, pithy comment. In case anyone's wondering who Oliver Wendell Holmes was, he was a Supreme Court Justice in the United States of America. I had lots of little pithy sayings that he came up with. SARS is the organization that is mandated to collect the revenue. Obviously, we try to do that in the most efficient and effective way possible. And that means we need to administer the tax legislation that has been assigned to us. The tax legislation falls into two categories. The one category is the category that you've already dealt with earlier, which is things like the Tax Laws Amendment Bill, which deals with the actual way tax is charged, the rates, the base of the tax. And the other part of the tax legislation is how you administer the legislation. Interestingly enough, our constitution, in fact, envisages the split of the two, which is why you would typically see two taxation laws amendment bills every year, one dealing with the actual levying of tax, imposition of tax, and the other dealing with the administration. The tax administration bill is a logical step in that direction. So the idea here is that we bring all the provisions in the various tax acts, some of which are over 60 years old and some of which are only 3 years old, together in one piece of legislation so that we can be consistent insofar as we can be. Obviously, each tax has its own little peculiarities, and those are still dealt with in that tax legislation. But as far as possible, we've tried to consolidate the legislation and align it. Why do we need the bill? Well, as I've just said, some of our legislation goes back 60 years. We've updated it over time, but the framework creaks a little. And we've moved into a new era. We're all aware of things like e-filing. We've grafted that into the existing legislation, but we're creating the platform for the next set of steps forward. Clearly, what the bill also tries to do is get a balance between taxpayers and SARS, and so we've taken various measures like building in criteria for discretions and the like to try and ensure that that balance is maintained. The other useful side effect of this bill is that the administrative parts of the Income Tax Act, about 25% of that act. And so once we've moved that chunk out of the Income Tax Act, that's a first step to rewriting the Income Tax Act, which is a process that's ongoing with my colleagues at National Treasury. I've touched on this already, but just some examples of the kinds of changes that the TAB facilitates. It's the move to a single registration. I mean, at the moment, businesses have a registration for income tax, they have one for value-added tax, they have one for employers' tax, employees' tax, and so on. The idea here is that we will enable the phased move to a single registration number, one registration with SARS as opposed to multiple. Internationally, the move is to self-assessment, where you don't have to wait for SARS to assess you. You can assess yourself. Again, the bill proposes a framework for allowing that shift from assessment to self-assessment. And then we need to modernize our accounting systems. They're tweaking a little as well. And so there's a framework for that accounting transformation. We think there are benefits both for SARS and for taxpayers. We've tried to simplify the legislation. It's going to be more consistent now, and that's to the benefit of all. Now, whilst we recognize that most taxpayers are compliant and they want to have a better tax administration, there is a significant minority that would rather like it if we were an inefficient and ineffective administration, because they're trying to evade tax or defraud government. So what the Tax Administration Bill also proposes are a set of measures that assist in closing down on that segment of the community. And so there are a set, battery running low. I think we need a transformer on this. Too late. The technology is, of course, reliant on infrastructure. This is, of course, the downside of modern technology. It's wonderful when it works, but when it doesn't, things tend to grind to a halt.
A church minister also once took their laptop to the pulpit and then nothing appeared on the screen, so we went back to the manual way of preaching.
Now we need a password. Now we have the next problem, which is that being very security conscious, someone has a password set on this machine, and it's not my machine. Yes. Alright. Is there a spare hard copy that I just quickly run off? Sorry about that. Thanks. All right. We switched to the low-tech solution, which is paper. Paper doesn't need power. The idea then is that clearly we want to give a better service to our compliant taxpayers, but equally when it gets to the tax evaders, we need some stricter powers to deal with them. Obviously, in the modern era, we live in a constitutional democracy. The question of the constitutionality is important. That's something we've borne very clearly in mind whilst drafting this. We haven't tried to build everything into the bill. The very simple reason, if you do, you run the risk of getting it wrong and, in fact, limiting rights that you're, in fact, trying to protect. So we rely on the existing legislation that protects rights where that those provisions are applicable. Our backup is in place. Right. International benchmarking. I know one of the members last time around had a comment about international best practice, so let me rephrase it and say this is international good practice. We're informed by the developments that have taken place around the world. We've mentioned some of the countries we looked at. We did look at others as well, but those were the primary countries we looked at. We've gone through an extensive consultative process around this bill. The first closed workshops on this with the profession were held back in May of 2009. Then there were two draft bills released for public comment. We've had extensive engagements around them. It was introduced in June, and we've now gone through another set of extensive engagements on the bill, which have resulted in a number of changes, which I will highlight. General comments. People welcome the bill. They like it. The language they find easier to read. They think it gives welcome clarity and consistency. But there are some areas of debate. We've flagged those there for you. And in fact, from the questions that the chair has read out, the very first one is an area that was of interest to this committee. So the tax ombud, where does it come from? Well, interesting, if you look at the international experience, tax ombuds are relatively rare. Most countries get by without them. They either simply use internal review mechanisms or they rely on their equivalent of the public protector to handle issues. The idea of an independent tax ombud came up in the Katz Commission reports, and at that time the Joint Standing Committee looked at that and said, no thanks, we think it should just continue to live in the public protector's office. We're worried about fragmentation. The issue, though, is that you need some specialized skills when you're dealing with tax, and that is part of the difficulty. You need someone who knows how the tax system works, both from a legal perspective and from a systems point of view. And so that does lead to some challenges. So hence we're back proposing a tax ombud. Now, we have two kinds of disputes in tax law. We've got people who are disagreeing about how much tax they have to pay, and there's an extensive mechanism available to resolve those issues. There are low-cost options there, like alternative dispute resolution and a tax board, and then for the bigger issues, you can go all the way up to the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court. When it comes to administration of law, we thought this is where the tax ombud would slot in, as it does internationally. And where it slots in is between SARS's internal mechanisms and the public protector and the courts. So clearly the public protector retains her mandate to continue to look at issues that relate to SARS. That's a constitutionally granted mandate. But as something that is more specialist, the tax ombud is proposed. I've already spoken to that last point, which is that taxpayers are always in a position to request SARS to reconsider its decisions or to move forward. So the ombud is something that is in addition to that, but as a stop before you need to go to more formal mechanisms. So there's the idea of how it would work. why does it work this way? Well, the idea is to ensure that the Ombuds office isn't overwhelmed. So try and resolve the issue using your internal processes, if possible, and then escalate them. The tax ombud does, however, retain the discretion to accept issues without that escalation process having been followed. So if it's a particularly serious issue, a particularly worrying issue, the tax ombud can accept it immediately. Okay, the mandate. As I've mentioned, it's about administrative issues. The Minister of Finance appoints the ombud, determines terms of office. The situation remains that it's staff that are seconded to the ombud's office. But a change has been made here, which is to make it clear that it is the ombud that drives the process. In other words, the ombud pulls the staff rather than the SARS pushing the staff to the ombud's office. So it's the ombud selects the staff in consultation with the commissioner. The potential also exists for the ombud to particularly request that staff members be employed, SARS would then employ them and succumb them to the ombud's office. Funding is out of SARS's budget, the practical issue here. The Ombuds Office internationally tends to be relatively small. To try and set up an accounting officer and all the relevant accounting procedures for an Ombuds Office really doesn't warrant the extra expenditure, so most Ombuds are funded out of the revenue. In fact, all Ombuds are funded out of the Revenue Administration. Powers to review and mediate in issues, and then some important changes. The annual report that the Ombud gives the Minister will now be tabled in the National Assembly. Okay, so it will be a public document so that committees can engage with it and the public can engage with it. And I've in fact touched on these issues. So staff selection driven by the Ombud. The second I have not touched on. The previous version of the bill proposed that the annual report cover at least the 10 most common issues taxpayers were faced with. That has now been extended to also include systemic and emerging issues that the Ombud feels require reporting on. So the report is also broader, and as I've mentioned, it is tabled in Parliament. So that gives the public a great deal more insight into what the Ombud's views are of how SARS is performing, and the opportunity to hold SARS to account for any shortfalls that may exist. All right. Well, let's have another little quote. To tax and to please no more than to love and be wise is not given to men. That is a rather old quote. It dates back to the tax system that was being imposed on the Americans, which was then changed and led to a little revolution. So very wise words there. We understand that some people won't be happy with what we have here, but we believe that most people will be. Right. I now move on to an overview of the significant changes. This slide members will have seen already. It's just a quick recap of some of the changes that happened over the consultative process prior to the introduction of the bill. And so, in fact, the idea of the tax ombud was inserted in the bill as part of that consultative process. Another example is we were suggesting that people who were leaving South Africa needed to notify us before they did. Somebody pointed out very wisely that that was not enforceable because if people didn't bother to let us know, what we were going to do about it. Fair comment. One should never have law that is not enforceable. So that provision was dropped. Third one, taxpayers can be requested for information regarding third parties. Taxpayers were concerned that meant that we would ask them to get information for them. So there's a limitation on that request. It's only information that the taxpayer maintains or should reasonably maintain. And so it goes. There are a number of changes here, which I think we've already touched on. For those people who've made a mistake in the past, I'll just touch on the last one. There will now be a permanent voluntary disclosure program so that people can come forward and essentially let SARS know that they've got a problem with their tax without fear of having a penalty imposed on them or if it's really serious, at least a reduced, very much reduced penalty, and also no criminal prosecution. Right. Then came the process before the Standing Committee, and a number of submissions were made. Now, one point that came up was people were saying, well, attorneys have legal professional privilege, other should have it too, accountants, basically anybody who's in the tax field. And the response here is that the international practice on this one is very different. Some countries grant it, some countries grant a very narrow one, some countries do not grant it at all. So, as an example, Canada does not. Germany does, but they regulate their tax practitioners quite heavily. Australia is thinking about it at the moment. They've got a discussion paper out. That's closed. They are still considering what to do about this. So this is not an easy area. There are lots of competing issues here. Lawyers are regulated by the courts and their bar associations. Tax practitioners, not so much. So the suggestion here is that this be held over. We have something called the Regulation of Tax Practitioners Bill that has been in process for a while, and this is something that could be considered as part of that bill, because we would think that as a minimum, if you're going to give people this kind of privilege, there should be some kind of regulation to go with it too. Search without a warrant, again, an issue of debate. This remains pretty much unchanged, with one significant change we'll come to, but the point here is that it is in very narrow circumstances. There's been a constitutional review of this. People are comfortable with it, at least on our side, and we've had independent counsel look at this too, and internationally this is pretty much on par. In fact, some countries would look at how we're doing this and say, why are you so strict? So we believe this is being strict is appropriate. Right, some of the changes, significant ones. Currently you're supposed to keep your records for 5 years. If you're in the middle of an audit or a dispute with SARS, obviously you should keep those records until those audit or dispute is concluded. Some people pointed out, well, what if the taxpayer didn't know the audit was in progress yet? In other words, we were in our preliminary steps. So fair enough, the change that has been proposed there and accepted by the committee was that it's only extended where the taxpayer is notified or aware of an audit. So if that's fair, then they must be bound to keeping the records. There is the idea of being able to inspect premises to see if the person is registered for tax and keeping records. That has been retained, but it's been clarified that only applies to business premises. So if you're doing business, SARS can knock on your door and say, hi, who are you? Are you registered for tax and are you keeping records? That's all those inspections are about. For something more in depth, there's a separate process. The bill also proposed the idea of being able to call people into a SARS office to discuss tax affairs so that you didn't have to have an audit, which could be disruptive for the taxpayer. Now, that extended to third parties. In other words, SARS could call Mr. A in to discuss Ms. B's affairs. That has been eliminated. It's not only an interview with the taxpayer, because it's the taxpayer who benefits by not having to have an audit in future. And then also to eliminate concerns about having to travel long distances to a SARS office, the taxpayer has a right to decline the interview if the travel distance is excessive. Now, the distance will be specified by notice. The reason for that is that what we're thinking of here is graduating the distance depending on the amount. So if it's a small amount, short distance. If it's a very big amount, a longer distance. Because clearly, if we're talking about 10 or 20 million rand, you probably are more willing to travel than if we're talking a few hundred rand. So that is the idea there. Jeopardy assessments, these are assessments that could be issued ahead of when an assessment would normally be issued, because there's a risk of the tax being placed in jeopardy because people are perhaps thinking of leaving the country or moving the assets outside of the reach of SAR somehow. So that is a power that's proposed. People were concerned that this might be exercised too often. So now it's the commissioner's approval that is required before we exercise this power. And so that should make sure it's only ever done in selected circumstances. I should mention that obviously the commissioner can delegate that power personally to senior officials. And then once that jeopardy assessment's been issued, the burden on proof is on SARS that it was reasonable to do so. So this is something that should not happen too often. Third party liability, there's circumstances where somebody other than the taxpayer can be held liable. So for example, perhaps you got assets at below market value from the company, and you could be held liable for the loss of value under certain circumstances as a shareholder, for example. What we're doing here is we're saying you have an opportunity for representations to SARS before we do this. And we also clarify that the third party has the same rights as the original taxpayer to dispute the liability. Percentage-based penalties. There was a little glitch here. There is the possibility of having an administrative penalty waived if you have just cause for having it waived. And that particularly applies where it's in a first offence or a minor non-compliance. Now, those waivers are capped, but a percentage-based, and that's because those administrative penalties are normally capped. So there's a cap and a cap. When we're talking percentage-based, though, I mean, a percentage is by its nature not capped. I mean, a percentage, 10% of something could be however big the something is. So we've removed the cap there to ensure that that is fair. Understatement penalties. The penalties were reduced to zero only in two cases. That has now been extended so that more behaviors are covered when people come forward. That is in clause 223 if anybody's interested in the precise details. But the idea here is to make it more attractive for people to come forward and make a voluntary disclosure. If someone's engaged in sort of deliberate tax evasion, however, there is still a small penalty, even if you come forward voluntarily. It's either 5 or 10%. But if you've just made a mistake or you've taken an aggressive position, but it is arguable, if only weakly, you can have your penalty reduced to zero. The concept of what is known as a substantial understatement penalty was proposed by the bill. Two changes were proposed in this area as well. The one was to make sure that it would only be applicable to the very largest taxpayers. So that is where the understatement, so the tax involved, is R1 million or 5% of the tax properly chargeable, whichever is the greater. So we're talking about large taxpayers here. And then even in those cases, if you've made full disclosure and you have an opinion that indicates that you are more likely than not to succeed in taking the position that you've taken, then the understatement penalty can be waived. So that allows people to take positions in good faith, but we do expect a full disclosure and due diligence when you do that. At that point, I'm not sure if you'd like me to move on to the chapter by chapter where we go through the details, or if you would like to stop at that point.
Honourable members, you want the clause by clause briefing? Silence. Honourable Bloom.
Chairperson, I think it's not necessary for today. The clause-by-clause issue. I think we will deal with it later. That's my proposal.
Honourable Mashile.
Yeah, Chair, I think he should be having some reasonable knowledge on those specific areas where it's clear in his mind that there are contradictions and we are not agreeing, or there is no consensus, or even from the standing committee, there are questions. I think if you could talk to those things and avoiding those things that there are no problems, then it's continuation of the existing law. Thanks.
I refer to the questions that I mentioned that were posed at the previous briefing, so if that could be addressed. I've got it here in writing if you want this. You took note that we, if that is okay with the members, it was our first meeting we had with Mr. Tomacek, that you address that. Thank you. The Honourable Lees.
Mr. Chairman, through you, if one looks at the presentation, in the various chapters there are words which are in a mauve. Those are the changes, presumably. So that's fine. I'm happy with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Lees. Mr. Tomacek, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. On the question of the seconded staff, let me start off with the international best practice point. Honourable members hopefully did get a copy of the briefing note we prepared on the question of the Tax Ombuds Office, but just to recap briefly on it. As I mentioned earlier, tax ombuds are relatively rare internationally, so we had to look around and try and find countries that did have them, and three come to mind. There is the UK, there is Canada, and there is the United States of America. Now, it's very interesting because in the United Kingdom, the equivalent of the tax ombud, called the tax adjudicator, is appointed by contract. There's no legislative basis for that appointment. And that contract is with Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. And that has been extended over time to cover a couple of other related institutions, but it's a purely contractual arrangement. The office is funded by the Revenue Administration, it is staffed by revenue officials, it is the person at the head who is the external party and oversees it. The annual report is made available publicly. If anyone's interested in seeing a copy of her contract, it's on her website in the UK. The next model then to look at, one other point. The UK is interesting in that it does have the equivalent of a public protector called the Parliamentary Ombud. So that was the solution the UK found to locating something between the administration and the equivalent of the public protector. Because you do need to be careful that you are not doing what the Joint Standing Committee was worried about all those years ago, which is fragmenting the role of the public protector. So you need something which is slightly below, subordinate to the public protector. Now, if you go to Canada, they do not have the equivalent of a federal public protector. And there, the equivalent of the Ombuds Office is established by regulation. So again, not a statutory or a primary statutory institution. Again, staffed by revenue staff, funded by the administration, and reports to the minister. The minister would table that report in Parliament, again a public document. The US, very similar model. The taxpayer advocate is appointed by the equivalent of the Minister of Finance. In fact, in that model, reports to the commissioner for the IRS, which is very interesting. But to counterbalance that, submits an annual report both to the Senate and to the House. Staffed by revenue officials and funded by the revenue office. Now, why that model? Well, I've touched on the funding part already, which is that in the greater scheme of things, the Ombuds Office is usually quite small. So to try and duplicate processes and procedures and create a whole new infrastructure for a relatively small office is quite ineffective. As far as the staffing is concerned, pulling the staff in from the Revenue Administration makes sure that you have insight into the systems and the processes and of course the law that needs to be applied. Of course, that does mean people worry about independence, but the point is you're reporting to an independent ombud who is going to report publicly. And I think that, that last bit is quite important, and I think it was a very useful change that was proposed, the public reporting. So that if, and I'm putting it very boldly, some people worry, well, what happens if SARS doesn't want to give enough funds to the Ombuds Office? Well, I can imagine that that will be one of the first things in the Ombuds report the very next time at his table, that there is a problem with funding. So that that can be interrogated to see, is there really a problem with funding? So that public oversight is a very important role. Right. Then the I think that covers the ombud issues. The issues around suspicious activities at somebody's residence, because the idea of a search without a warrant is limited to business premises. If you look at the constitutional law, the right to privacy is strongest when you're talking about someone's home. And the courts are very, very reluctant to allow an invasion of that privacy. So it's very difficult to justify a search without a warrant of someone's home. And that is why the provisions here are restricted to business premises or the part of a person's home that is used for business. So if we are worried that somebody is doing something in their home which is not in a business part of their business premises, then the simple answer is we have to get a warrant. And that is the trade-off we have in a constitutional democracy. That's what the courts believe is the dividing line, and so that is the line that we have implemented here. As to other contentious issues, I think we've highlighted the ones that, that were subjects of discussion. There were a number of amendments that were proposed and then accepted by the Standing Committee. In fact, one was something that came out of the informal meeting we had here, which was the question of the taxpayer doesn't put their reference number on a piece of correspondence they send to SARS. And we said, well, SARS can disregard it then. And the question was raised, well, what happens when SARS disregards it? How's the taxpayer supposed to know? So you will see there's now a provision that says SARS must notify the taxpayer that they are disregarding the correspondence, if practical. Okay, why if practical? Well, if I get a letter from John Smith and there's no address on it, and there's no reference number on it, well, I can't notify John Smith that I'm disregarding his letter. So hence the if practical. But there is now a feedback loop. So there were a number of changes that were made, and I think we have addressed the issues that were brought before the committee. I think that covers it, Chair.
Honourable members, questions. Honourable Mashile, I just want to note the names. Honourable Lees, Honourable Monsisi, in that order.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think really there are issues that we have to discuss and issues that still remains questionable from SARS. Chair, what I'm picking up really, I think I did raise this particular matter before. It's SARS relying on developed countries to import, you know, systems, forgetting that our country is still developing. And really in infant stage, but we are importing A1 systems, you know, to really influence our systems, and I really have a problem with that. And you'll remember last time I think when we spoke to them, I was worried why the study was done to these imperialistic states, when ours, it's not necessarily in that league. We are a little bit different from the US, UK, and Canada. Probably that's the main reason. Even now, we are differing with Canada in COP17, because really we are different. But administratively, we import some of their measures. But whereas, you know, the thrust of government, it's a little bit different from those states. I really find it. You know, there may be aspects that may be of assistance to us, but importing the whole system as is, it is a little bit problematic to me. Chair, I still need to be convinced. Otherwise, Chair, I would really insist that it is not correct to have the ombudsman located within SARS. It doesn't provide the checks and balances. It doesn't. It will never. And the very same reason why they wanted the ombudsman to be within SARS is exactly the same reason we would like it to be outside SARS. Chair. And the next question, Chair, is why should staff be employed by SARS then seconded to ombudsman? What induction you want to give to this staff before they go to the ombuds office? What is there that you want to teach them? Is it to continue to be protective of SARS, even when SARS is abusing the system and abusing people? Why do you want them to via the SARS department before they actually go the other side? Surely that, it raises a lot of questions. Because I can say, Chair, one thing that one have noted for past couple of years is that all departments of government, there are officials that are fingered for corruption, for abuse of certain things. But, Chair, I haven't heard of a SARS official or a Treasury official being fingered for corruption or for as if those departments are holy. There should be something that's happening that it's not correct. Because they are all handling money, they've got procurement systems, they are ordinary people like all other officials in other departments that are being taken to court because of making certain mistakes and whatever. But with SARS or Treasury, you'll never come across that. Surely the system is protective or is highly protective or something is happening there that needs to be corrected, that, we definitely have to have a system that is self-correcting and it is clean and it is not being seen to be manipulated, for objectives that we don't agree on, all of us. So I think those are the two issues that I wanted to raise. Let me just hint the last one, Chair. Yeah. I had an experience, Chair, that if in SARS you have to pay, say, UIF, not UIF, what is that? It's UIF, yes. I think so. And then it's VAT, and then it is income tax, and then you have got the specific tax numbers for all those. But what happens, even if, it is a company, you have got one company registration number. If you pay your tax, either income tax, and you have overpaid, or for some reason, SARS has refunded you, but you owe on VAT, then they are not able to transfer the money into that one that you are owing. They will keep your overpayment on the specific tax, but continue and charge you interest on the other one. While you have got money for tax, but being in one and then, but they can't deal with the others on the same company registration number. You accrue interest while you have got money stashed in one tax within SARS. And really, when we interacted with SARS, normally, Chair, I'm sure you will come across that SARS officials are very, very arrogant, Chair. Let one say it. SARS officials are seriously arrogant. The Vatupil principles is something taboo in SARS officials. I'm not talking about the senior officials. The officials on the front line that we interact with and then we deal with, generally they are really arrogant. And but my main worry is that one, that why should you have extra 5,000 rand in tax on income tax, but then you owe 3,000 rand on VAT or something else, and then SARS is happy to accrue interest on the one that you are owing, while they are having this one on the one side, on the same income, in the company registration number, where when you press one button there, all your tax things comes up on the screen. Thanks, sir.
I must say I paid an unofficial visit to the new SARS office in Kimberley, and it was a pleasant visit and a pleasant surprise of very cooperative people working there. In the previous meeting I said I would do an oversight visit there. Yes, in 1994, when we started the Democratic Parliament and provincial legislators, Canada, Sweden, Germany were actively involved in getting us on our feet in terms of governance, etc. Even in my province, officials were sent to Canada and Sweden to get training how to run a department. So yes, there was involvement, and definitely involvement regarding the tax administration, etc. So there are connections. In South Africa, we are a bit unique. We have a world in one country. If you go and look who's living in this country. So we have to cater for everyone. Makes it a bit difficult, but I think we are succeeding and can learn, teach Europe a few lessons. Still battling with the Eurozone. On the lease.
Chairman, through you, the tax ombud is quite an issue, as we all know. I need a little bit of clarity about a couple of things. First is, it's a kind of intermediate step, as I understand. Is it mandatory that one uses it? So you've shaken your head, so I understand the answer already. That's fine. Then the appointment of the ombud. We've talked about his staff or her staff, and there's a convent from SARS. But just clarify for me the actual appointment of the tax ombud themselves. Contract length, whatever. The question of graduated distances to be called into a SARS office is a concerning one. If you're going to graduate it because of the amount, then surely that's a greater incentive for SARS to go to the taxpayer rather than the other way around. I really don't think it should be graduated. I think it should be left to the taxpayer to either accept the invitation or decline the invitation. And if he declines, then it's up to SARS to decide whether they want to then pursue it by going. I mean, in my own case, I have to travel 150 kilometers to get to the closest SARS office. And it's a call that we will continue to make, that there have to be more offices around the country. We cannot just locate offices at a distance from taxpayers simply because there are not that many taxpayers in a particular area. The issue of the credits on a taxpayer's account is in fact an interesting one. I'm following up on Honourable Mashila because I have a particular case with PAYE at the moment. I personally paid twice for 1 month's PAYE earlier this year, and I've been trying for 4 months to get that credit transferred to another period of PAYE, not even to another form of tax within the same computer system has like silos. It only operates PAYE one silo and so on, and I can't get it done. And now I know I'm going to be charged penalties and interest on the period that I haven't paid deliberately because I double paid on another. And so that is an issue just to support Honourable Mashida that really needs to be addressed. And I don't know that you can really answer that question now, but except to say, yes, we'll go and try and fix it. In terms of the staff, sorry to go back to the Ombudsman, they seconded from SARS to work for an independent Ombud. Who assesses their performance and their bonuses and all the rest of it? Because that obviously will dictate to some extent how they perform. Chairman, thank you. This is the second briefing, and thank you for coming yet again to brief us. Given the changes that takes place, it's probably necessary, but still, it's great to see you again.
Thank you, Honourable Lees. Welcome to the Deputy Minister, Karim. We received a note of apology for you, but welcome here. We are still busy with the tax administration bill, nearly done, and then we will zoom into the issue that we requested the ministry to be present. Thank you. You want to say something, Deputy Minister?
Sincerely, I was on my way to the Portfolio Committee, set plan of the cooperative governance. Now, it's my fault. The minister had phoned me at about 5 to 12 last night, but I only picked the message up at about 20 past 9, so I had to come all the way back. It was a confusion. He was meant to be here, but I only picked the message up. I don't know what happened. Thank you. So I had to come all the way back from Francia. Thank you.
Honourable Minister, now we welcome and thank you for being present here. Honourable Lees. Another question? Office in Newcastle.
No, Ladysmith, please. Newcastle can live. Just clarify for me the reporting tabling. You specifically say the NA. Where does the NCOP fit into this? Parliament, as we know, does not consist of just the NA. And so why isn't it tabled first in the NCOP for a change?
Yeah, that's procedure, but thank you for the point. At the previous meeting, I also mentioned the question of an office in Springbok. That's for the western part of the Northern Cape. If you look at the distances, and especially the people living in the small towns, in the rural areas, in the region of Namakwa, the regional service point and town and capital of the region is Springbok. Like Uppington for Sianda, DR for Pixley, and Kimberley for Francis Barth, and Kuruman for Jantauli, that you will have to look at more offices specific in those provinces with the huge rural areas. As the President said, we must bring the services to the people. Honourable Montsisi.
Thank you, Chair. On page 13. Yes, page 13 of the presentation. There's a second point there. Under the changes that have been effected, that of the removal of advance notice of leaving South Africa. I'm not quite sure what this refers to, Chairperson. Whether it refers to any investor who may not necessarily have to inform of his pending departure. And obviously there are consequences if that happens, because that would also affect the income to the fiscus. And it would be more like giving a license to capital flight. I'm not sure what it means, so I just need the issues that the Honorable Mashile has raised about the research that is being done in the Western and most developed countries. They are also a source of concern for me. There's no problem in learning from those most developed countries. All I'm saying is we tapped in together right now with developing economies like we have established in BRICS. And if we develop together with these particular countries, then why not we benchmark ourselves against countries that are growing the economy like we are? And then my last question, Chairperson, it's just clarity on whether there could be recourse for the ombudsman here. It seems like he's dealing with... Okay, never mind. Now, my question is whether there could be recourse for ordinary taxpayers who have recovered their records after one or two financial years. You know, you suddenly recover your records. Is there any recourse? Thank you.
Thank you to Honorable Mafisi. Any other members that want to put a question? None. Mr. Tomacek, you may reply.
Thank you, Chair. Let me reassure honorable members immediately that we did not simply accept what the developed countries had on offer. We are very mindful of the fact that the complexity of their systems is such that we probably can't import them, and we probably wouldn't want to import them wholesale. And you just have to look at the Inland Revenue Code of the United States of America to realize that that is not a road you particularly want to follow. Let me just give you an example. The appointment of the tax adjudicator is dealt with in section 7803 of the Inland Revenue Code. So that gives you just a sense of what we're looking at there. So when we look at these countries, we look at what they have to offer in the context of South Africa. So we're certainly not going to take clauses and just import them and bring them in. I should also emphasize that we are very mindful as well of our developing countries that we work with. So, for example, South Africa on the tax terrain works in a grouping called IBSA, which is India, Brazil and South Africa. And I had the honor of addressing some of the graduates, soon to be graduates of the Inland Revenue in India's academy for their senior staff on the way the South African tax system works, and talk to them about how theirs works. So these are issues that we're well aware of. We have not imported wholesale. We have picked and chosen what we have brought in. Why do we look at these countries? Because a lot of the developing countries that we could benchmark are also battling with legislation they've inherited that is very old. So they sit in the same situation we do in some respects, in that you've got old legislation you've inherited and you need to modernize it. And clearly, if you're looking at where some of the trends are, you will be looking at some of the developed countries. But as I must emphasize, you need to locate that in a South African context, which we've certainly tried to do. On the ombud and its effectiveness, I think one of the
the points to make here is that the model we are using is the model that has been used elsewhere and has worked. Okay, if you look at the feedback you get on the effectiveness of, for example, the UK Ombud, which is arguably even less independent than this one is, in practice, it works. Okay, and so if you're looking at benchmarks for how an Ombuds office works, this is the model that does work. Now, it's not compulsory to use the Ombud. If you would prefer to lodge a complaint with the public protector, that is completely open to you. You do not have to have a pit stop at the Ombuds office first. If you would prefer to take SARS on review in the courts, you're perfectly able to do that as well. The Ombud is meant to be an additional low-cost option for taxpayers, which is quick and easy. Now, I have spoken with the staff of one of the Ombuds offices. I won't mention a name because it was an off-the-record discussion. And in fact, their experience is that once an issue is escalated to the Ombuds office, the turnaround time at the Revenue Administration is so fast that they have a problem with their metrics because they do not want anything in the annual report. It's seen as a negative for the staff that something would end up in the annual report or on the Ombuds desk. So I just offer that as an example of how that model actually does work. With respect to corruption and problems within SARS, I would certainly say we are not immune to that. We have suspended people. We have prosecuted people. There are prosecutions ongoing as I sit here with respect to problems with tenders and collusion between SARS staff and external syndicates to defraud the fiscus. In fact, if you have a look at our annual report, you will find some statistics on that. So I'm certainly not pretending we are perfect. We are not. But we have very strong processes in place. We have a code of conduct. We have an internal ethics office. And where we detect this kind of issue, we act without any tolerance whatsoever. The problem with allocations from one account to another, or even within an account, between the accounts I can sort of understand, because although there is a screen that allows us to see taxes across systems, it is across systems. We still have multiple diverse platforms that our systems are running on. And so getting the systems to talk to each other can be very difficult. And that is precisely why the bill proposes things like in a single account going forward, to try and assist. I'm sure that will have challenges of its own, but the idea is to try and assist in resolving those issues. With respect to our arrogant officials, I am very disappointed to hear that is your experience. I think people encounter a wide range of experiences in our offices. I've seen reports from people who are very happy. All I can ask is that where you run into that kind of problem, you do escalate it up to senior management so that we can address it. And that way, hopefully, the next taxpayer who goes into an office gets a better reception. The appointment of the Ombud, that is in the discretion of the minister. You will note, however, that the bill sets out some fairly strict requirements for dismissing an Ombud. So once the minister has made his choice, the minister is stuck with that choice, and the Ombud then needs to operate. Who assesses the performance of the staff? The Ombud does. And so that, again, gives you some reassurance. I mean, the Ombud is reporting to the minister and through the parliamentary processes, and the staff, even though seconded there, are measured for their performance by the Ombud. So you have the independence coming through that you need. On the graduated distances, well, that's an interesting counter proposal there, that we should not graduate. It's being set by way of notice,
So we'll obviously put that out for public comment so that people can engage with us as to how best they would like to see this being structured. The taxpayers I've spoken to so forth, it was a great idea to graduate above distance, on the theory that, remember, the idea of an interview is that you get away without having your business disrupted by having SARS people arrive and sitting there for a week auditing something that you could have explained in an hour across the desk from the auditor. So, but yeah, it's not cast in stone, so it's something that will still go through a process before we come to a final outcome on that. The credits within the pay-as-you-earn account, I'm fascinated. I'd love to know what's happening there. it is the same system. So I'd love to talk to my systems colleagues and ask them why you're running into that problem. Okay, advance notice of leaving. The Honourable Member is quite correct. There are a number of tax events that are triggered when somebody leaves South Africa. So if you were resident in South Africa and you emigrate, you become non-resident. There are tax events that occur. Now, the problem here is, as I say, that if we put an obligation on you, statutory obligations, criminal offence, you don't notify us if you don't tell us before you leave, and you don't tell us and you leave, well, what are we going to do? You are now sitting in Australia or wherever, Swaziland. We don't really have a handle on you. But, and this is where things like double taxation agreements become so important and mutual assistance in collections. Where that tax event is triggered and you now owe us money and we have a double taxation agreement with the jurisdiction you have moved to, and that agreement has an assistance in collection clause, we will invoke that clause and collect the money that is due. And our fellow administration in that jurisdiction will collect the funds and send them back to us. So that is where we then use the treaty system to get to the result that we need to, rather than trying to do it in our legislation, which is going to be ineffective. And then the question around records that you find after 1 to 2 years, I suspect what the Honourable Member is asking about there is maybe there's some income that you didn't disclose and you discover a year later and you sort of go, ooh, that's a problem. I should have put that in my tax return. And that is the point of the Permanent Voluntary Disclosure Program. It creates a mechanism for you to come to SARS, say, look, I made this mistake, and you can then bring that into the tax system without having a penalty being imposed on you or fearing any sort of criminal prosecution from SARS aside. So that is the whole idea of the voluntary disclosure program that's being inserted. Chair, just on your pleasant experience in Kimberley, I'm very glad that you had that experience. I'll pass that on to you. And then just on the question of officers, I think I'll have to get one of my colleagues who's responsibility this is to come and sit in the hot seat on that one. I did discuss the matter with him, and I think members will recall that the last time I was here I spoke about our mobile offices that we were trying out. Apparently there are three of them. We have them operating in the Eastern Cape, KZN and Limpopo. I've learned that they've been pretty successful. People like them. What we're now going to try as an alternative is partnering with some of the municipalities to try and get a sort of an office in some of the smaller locations. At this point, we're trying to find a solution that works, but I can't give you more details than that. If necessary, we can get my colleagues who are involved with that to speak to you. Chair, I do believe that covers the issues that have been raised. I'll hand it back to you.
Are you done? Thank you. Honourable Mashile, I believe there's the Select Committee on the Joint Committee on Intelligence is also having a meeting now, and our members are also engaged in that meeting. We must take decisions, so we need a quorum. I want to ask Honourable Mashile can we just deal with this legislation to, and then we can release you, please. Honourable Mashile.
Chairperson, I think I still have to make some 2-3 comments, Chair. The I actually just wanted to comment, Chair, on the Ombudsman's office. I continue to have reservations, Chair. When we create these offices to operate independently, then they must be seen to be independent. If they are not seen to be independent while we claim that they are independent, then we defeat the objectives. And again, is that the comment that we have received that anyone that is not pleased to go to the Ombudsman can go to the Public Protector or otherwise any other. That kind of a comment, Chair, is unfortunate because it's an arrogant comment, Chair. Because when we create an office to service people, then people must see value and they must go to the office and they must get service. Not that if they are not happy about it, and then they can as well go and find another office somewhere else. It must be seen to be independent, to be giving service to people. That is what one is saying, Chair. But you see, my argument, Chair, at the beginning, while I was actually questioning the intentions of SARS with the Ombudsman's office, is because, Chair, I'm experiencing it for the second time. You will remember when we started the issue of a budget office, at the budget office here. SARS wanted to actually second people there. Now we're talking about an ombuds, an office that they must actually portray it to be independent for people that are not happy about SARS activities to go there as well to get a service. Then they want to second people there. You're having a typical attitude from SARS that it has the best people. Or Treasury has got the best people, you know, to deploy in these offices. They cannot be found anywhere else. That chair is a little bit problematic to me because I'm seeing it now for the second time, and which create a problem that there is something that Treasury as well as SARS wants to maintain a particular way of doing things without opening a specific office that is supposed to be independent. You know, to actually look to be independent. And Chair, then the next one was the issue of the jeopardy assessment. I would, Chair, have preferred if that approval being made by the Ombudsman rather than the Commissioner. Because definitely the Commissioner is part of the staff that are actually having this particular interest. If they feel that, no, you are going to go, and then you want an independent assessment whether that should be done, it's better to be, you know, to be done by the Ombudsman rather than the Commissioner. And I would have preferred it to be that way. That will actually present an objective decision making on the circumstances whether we are not just simply portraying this particular taxpayer that is going when it's not going. So an external approval or voice there then becomes much more important. Otherwise, I mean, the senior official in SARS, if it decides to do that, surely the Commissioner is going to agree. I mean, it's not going to refuse because rely on those people with the delegated powers. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Mashile. We will capture this in our report that will be tabled in the House. I presume it will be either on the 6th or the 7th of December. So we are capturing all the issues raised by the Honourable Members. We will have a session with the Honourable Minister of Finance and Deputy Minister for Finance in February when we deal with the national budget, the fiscal framework and revenue proposals. So there we will have the executive authority present. Honourable Chani?
No, Chair, thanks. Chair, I just want to understand, Honourable Mashile, correctly in light of what you are saying? Is he raising proposals to effect changes to the bill so that it addresses those issues that he has raised? Or is he just merely raising concerns that can be noted? Because from where I'm seated, it's like he's actually making firm proposals that there's a need for some amendments to the bill as it stands to address those issues. And if I'm correct, then it can't be that we just note those in the report. Not unless, of course, I'm not sure whether we've got any time pressures to adopt and pass this bill today or next week, such that it can't even be possible for us as a committee to engage further with the minister and whoever is responsible for this bill until those issues that we are raising as a committee are adequately addressed. And if there's a need for any amendments, so be it. But I'll be guided by Honorable Mashile, because listening to his views, and he's been very consistent in terms of this, they are valuable points. And just noting them, it's like saying, well, we hear you, but we can't make any amendments. We can, as a committee. But you can guide me, Chair. Thanks.
Alder Mashile, can you address that?
Chairperson, I think it may be unfortunate that one may not have canvassed other than canvassing in here. But definitely, Chair, like as I've indicated, I would be much more happy that office of the Ombudsman, and then it is seen to be independent, not to be a theoretical thing. And I have serious reservations even on the process why these officials must fire through SARS before they land up. And to say the Ombudsman can only pick workers in SARS into his or her office, he can't go out there. What is that we are trying to do by putting that kind of a system? I really have a problem. That's why I'm saying, Chair, is it needs to be seen to be independent. But if it is seen to be part of staff, then it is going to be problematic for people that are dissatisfied by what they have received or what the problems they have come across in staff, and going to another SARS official whom we claim that is independent when it is just a theoretical matter. What is the difficulty? What was the difficulty if that office is just outside SARS but reporting to the Minister of Finance? Not a problem. But just simply put the office outside SARS. What is the danger for SARS? Because that very danger that they think it is a danger is exactly the same reservations that people will have. And like as I'm saying, Chair, is that it's a continuation of what we have experienced when we're talking about the budget office as well. You'll remember that we had similar proposals coming from Treasury. You know, what is there that is being protected and is guarded and closely guarded? What is that? Because that is the one that removes the independence of that specific office. And really, Chair, that's what I would propose, but not with the intention to stall what needs to go forward. But if it is possible that it can be considered, Chair, I would be really happy. And also with this specific one that I've just raised of the jeopardy assessment. And because this is a proactive action. It's not necessarily a compliance thing that a taxpayer must comply is that we suspect that this person is going to run away. And then you need an independent assessment to the approval of for that particular action to happen. Not raised by a SARS official and approved by a SARS official. And then we go and then you clamp on a person. And if it is wrongly decided, those are the things, Chair.
It's a concern you are raising to be addressed by SARS. Am I understanding you correct? You're proposing an amendment. We just want it correctly minuted here.
That's correct, Chair. I was proposing that this jeopardy assessment to be actually referred to the ombudsman rather than the commissioner.
You want an amendment?
That's what I would propose, Chair.
Johnny?
No, Chair, I'm clarified. I'm not on my serious got a valuable point, but he's just afraid to say, let amend. I mean, that's what he wants, and I'm convinced that his points to a certain, not unless, of course, there is other information that we don't know that we will have to be briefed on, but perhaps there will be a need to further engage with the ministry on this particular proposal before we table this report, either with amendments or without amendments in the House.
Yes, then it won't be done next week. Mr. Tomacek?
Just a couple of points of clarity, if I may. First of all, SARS has nothing to do with the Budget Office, so that would have been a Treasury interaction. The second point I would simply make on the Ombuds Office is what we're talking about here is a set of practical measures, because if the Ombuds Office has to recruit only for the Ombuds Office, you're going to have a very limited career available to you. It's going to be a relatively small office. There are practical issues with understanding of SARS systems and the way SARS issues are worked through and where your best point of inquiry needs to go to. And that is precisely why if you look at the international models, they follow the model, or we are following the model that has worked for them. There is a briefing note which is available to members, which sets out that in some more detail, and I don't think I want to go to that too much further. With respect to the question of the Ombud authorizing jeopardy assessments, one danger one needs to guard against here is that it's the commissioner that has the responsibility for administering the tax acts, and that responsibility should not be diluted. However, we have put in certain safeguards with respect to that particular. As I've mentioned, it needs to be approved at the very highest level. And the second point is that that decision to issue a jeopardy assessment is reviewable by a court. And that is where the onus of proof becomes important, because it is SARS that needs to show that it was reasonable to issue a jeopardy assessment. Normally the onus is on the taxpayer to say why an amount shouldn't be taxed. In this particular case, it is SARS that needs to say why it was reasonable and state its case. So SARS starts off on the back foot on this one, not the taxpayer. Because it is SARS that has the knowledge to explain why it is that a jeopardy assessment was necessary. And so that is how we've attempted to balance. Again, this is not something that South Africa is coming up with out of the blue. This is a power that exists in other jurisdictions, and it's part of what the Revenue Administration is responsible for. And then just on the location of where the Ombuds Office fits in, I mean, just as you have a hierarchy of courts that you can approach, so what is being put in place here is a hierarchy of mechanisms you can use to address administrative issues. The difference being here, though, that whereas normally in the court system you have to start at the bottom and work your way up, here the taxpayer has the opportunity to select where they wish to enter the system.
Honourable members, I put it to the committee, to the members, once further engagement with the Honourable Minister for Finance on the bill. I'm listening.
Chairman, I'll support the idea that you put on the table and the problem that the Honourable Michelle has.
There was a proposal, Honourable Michelle.
Agreed.
This bill will then be held back, and we will engage with the Honourable Minister and see when a suitable date can be found. I don't know if it's possible, Cindy, before the 7th of December. You will have to guide us. Otherwise, it will stand over until January, February.
Honourable Member, I will have to go back to the office and then but I will liaise with you regarding Minister's availability. Deputy Minister's definitely not around, so it will be Minister. And Minister's also involved with the COP17, so we just have to see how we can fit it in.
Yes, I know they are busy with COP17, so we will see what can be done and what cannot be done. To the Honourable Minister, thank you for Mr. Tomaszek and his team. We will definitely then meet again in the near future. But I'm going to hold you. We've still got other business to do. Thank you for the Deputy Minister Karim that drove all the way back from Franschhoek. Yeah, the cell phone networks are sometimes distorted with their SMSs and messages. I experienced precisely the same thing. So, but thank you for coming and honoring this meeting with your presence. Honourable members, the draft reports on the visit of the Select Committee for Finance have been circulated to members during the course of yesterday, and you were requested to work through it and make additions, amendments, corrections. But a decision from this committee was that we engage with the executive regarding the visit to the Northwest. Honourable Minister, you also attended a meeting where we engaged with you on our visit to the Free State. Now, the findings is nearly the same. It's just a bit worse. The input made by Mr. Van Schalkwyk, the Auditor General for the Northwest, was that there was a regression in the performance and financial management overall in the Northwest Province. This was our second visit of the Select Committee for Finance to that province. We were there 14 months ago. Our method of operation is that we visit the province and after a year or so we go back to see what improvements were there, what progress was made. Did they give attention to the resolutions that were taken, not only from outside as a committee, but also giving attention to the findings of the Auditor General in his report on each municipality? Now, in this case, in the Northwest, they didn't interact or did anything regarding the findings of the Auditor General. And we engaged there also with the MEC for COPTA, the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee for COPTA and Finance were present, and we were a bit disturbed by the performance of that department in that province. It might be a capacity problem that you don't have enough people to send out as a part of a task team to visit the municipalities, but also, Honourable Deputy Minister, the interaction and coordination between Treasury and Finance, Treasury and COPTA. There must be definitely be better improvement on that side, and we were very blunt and to the point in our findings during those meetings with the municipalities. Did you give the Honourable Minister a copy of the report? You've got it in front of you. But before the Minister says something, are there any members that want to make inputs before the Minister responds? Chani is from the Northwest. Alba Monsisi, Alba Mashile. Start.
No, thanks, Chair. No. Chair, I think critical to the issues is the fact that apart of the point, Honourable Deputy Minister, that there seems to be regressing in terms of the performance of municipalities. But of great concern to us as the committee, like we had concerns in Free State, is that municipalities tend to employ the services of different service providers to do what they call forensic investigations. And once those investigations are completed, then they become reluctant to act upon the findings of those, particularly if most of them are implicated. And we saw that happening in Free State, Matabe Municipality, and Mwate, and so on and so forth. Now, the same situation is still prevailing in the Northwest. This is over and above the fact that in November last year, the President, by proclamation, instructed the SIU unit to investigate all those municipalities. Well, we're still waiting to know how far is those particular investigations, if any, because nobody seems to be sure as to whether they have been carried through or not, but perhaps you can shed some light on to that. But the point is that if you take municipalities like Makwasi Hills, you take Makosana, and many others, there are reports, forensic investigation reports, there are those reports where investigations were conducted by the Auditor General on the request of municipalities, but there's nothing that is happening. And our worry is that thousands and thousands of monies have been spent to do that, and there should have been a purpose for such investigations to be conducted. And these municipalities are not willing at all to act, such that in Makwasi Hills it has created serious problems that are beginning to affect the municipality, where even before the forensic report is tabled in the council, those who had had sight of it decided to push for the suspension of the MM, and municipality, as we speak, in just 2 months, having spent almost 750,000 in legal costs, because now there seems to be like one of the political parties here in the country. They are spending much time in court now, in that municipality, fighting to get rid of the municipal manager and all those things. It's within their right. All what we are concerned about is a small municipality fighting about the report that has not even been tabled, simply because others view that as an investigation that were meant to get rid of other people. So, I mean, I don't think that's how government should operate. But the bottom line is that we have situations where now there are a lot of this investigating forensic reports in municipalities which are just lying there without anybody taking action. And if anything would require the intervention of the department, because even provincial departments, like it was the case in Free State, even in Northwest, that department, as the chair said, is reluctant, or at best what they can come up with is to take those municipalities back under Section 139. Some of these problems can be addressed without putting municipalities under Section 139, but it would seem that the solution currently is to put any municipality that does not act or do what under Section 139. And this one, Section 139 again, one would expect that once a municipality is out of Section 139, whatever improvements and achievements made will then be sustained. But you find that once you remove the administrator, everything collapses. They go back to square number one, you see. In Northwest, we have seen some of these closeout reports that they are, say, the closeout reports on the administration. But those reports are just quiet in terms of what is it expected by those now in the driving seat in terms of sustaining those achievements. You go to Fendersdorp, municipality, for an example, in terms of their submission, they are still trapped in those contracts that were identified by your department, where somebody is collecting and taking 80% of the collection and giving municipality 20%. Where on earth have you ever seen that? It's happening there. It's still there. The contracts of the fleets. And as a result, that municipality depends largely on the hands out from the district. Let alone political interference that is there. But those are some of the challenges that a number of things that were identified by the national department which necessitated intervention remain as they were initially identified. In fact, at best, you find some of the administrators seconded to those municipalities now being the ones even defending some of those contracts which, in our view, were wrong and need to be corrected, so that municipalities have a breathing space insofar as their funds are concerned. But, I think from my side, I'm quite worried about the fact that we'll spend a lot of money on these investigations. And the day these documents reach public and people begin to protest, it's when we'll then be reacting and going there and saying, no, we'll do this and this. Like what happened in Mwathe, like what is also happening currently in Nala, you see. Because the situation in Nala is as a result of now people knowing that the KPMG report is out and it's saying this and this, and the same people who are culprits are still in the system. I mean, the other issue relates to the turnaround strategy. For the first time in Northwest, we are told that no, by the department now, provincial department, no, that turnaround, no, we can't see it through, we can't see it being implemented because it was never funded. There are no funds to implement it. It was quite a strange point that was being made. We followed up, I personally followed up with Elroy on that, and he was also taken aback and he was saying, but what is these people talking about? They need funds to implement that particular strategy. And the report that we have been receiving is that no, everybody is rolling the program, is beginning to show some signs of improvements. But I'm sorry to tell you that in Northwest, in terms of the reports presented by the MEC himself and his team, in Northwest, they are unable to make sure that municipalities implement that because there are no funds for that, which is a very quite strange thing. But and all our efforts to see at least some major achievement in terms of clean audit for 2014, that remains a pipe dream in that particular province. And surely some of these things need to be attended to jointly with the provincial department and the national department if we are to make any progress and impact in turning around the situation in municipalities. Well, the other issues can better be raised in a different forum than this one, because they relate to political interventions and all those things. But so from my side, those could be the issues that I think are important for consideration by the ministry. I thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the report on page 5 and 6. It alludes to all these amounts, unauthorized expenditures of 324 million, 132 million, 109 million, and those irregular expenditures of 28 million, 15, 20, and so on. Now, what you are saying, Chairperson, is that we've been able to go to the bottom of the maladministration, even in terms of the personnel that is responsible. Now, all we are saying is that the committee has decided to take action. If you refer to page 15 of the report talks of some of the recommendations that the committee has made with respect to investigations that should take place by the police. The various municipalities here, although the report does not specifically talk about Fender Stop to be investigated as well, we have indicated, I hope it will be corrected, we have indicated that the Fender Stop local municipality should also be investigated by the police. And the other municipalities like Gauteng River local municipality, and I think it's Moretele, including, is it Makwasi? Yeah, Makwasi local municipality. Yeah, these are local municipalities which the committee feels that the report has to be handed over. Firstly, to the public protector, and secondly, to the police for investigation. We are mindful of the repercussions that would ensue as a result of the investigations that has taken place, that would take place. But safe to say that there's no way in which the committee can continue to move from one province to the other and look at this abuse of state coffers and not act on them. So these are the recommendations that we have.
Are you done, Honourable Musisi?
I'm done.
Chile?
Can I go, Chief?
How long will you be away? Because we have to take decisions, and we can't take a decision if we don't correct.
Yeah, Chair, I really just wanted to make this comment for the Deputy Minister, probably as well as some of the officials that are here from COCT. Chair, I think there is a trend. There is a trend that is showing up. The trend is that the municipalities that have been put under Section 139, whether 3 or 4 years back until to now, these municipalities, when they try to turn a corner and the new council comes in, then they fire, suspend and officials in the municipality. There is this trend that is coming up. I really don't know how the National Department can actually deal with this matter. Because certain municipalities that try to turn the corner through the administration and then new people or whatever, or those that were there, then they have been mentored to really start seeing a particular way. And then comes a new council. Then the new council starts suspending people and all that and disturbs the balance, the administrative balance in the municipality, and which does not actually assist us. And when they do that, and then they get a new municipal manager, and then the new municipal manager starts firing other officials down in the form of suspensions or investigations, then the thing just reverberates down and disturbs the whole administrative, and the municipality goes back to the same situation of of non-performance or dysfunctionality. I think that is what I just wanted to raise with the Deputy Minister, that all the municipalities that have happened to be under Section 139, can we really closely and jealously guard them so that they don't lose the track either from itself going back to where it was, or the councils also disturbing, you know, the new way of doing things of coming out of the Section 139. And, Chair, the other issue, of course, it is the respect of the institutional arrangement in the municipalities. Because, Chair, I think I was seriously disturbed last week, Chair. Honorable Tanis, I think in passing has raised the matter. You know, where there is total disregard, then council does not respect the executive committee, and actually making the municipality dysfunctional, actually running the municipality dysfunctional, where council can sit in a council chamber and say, Mayor, get out. You can't be in here because you've got a relationship with a municipal manager or somebody else. You know, council actually entertaining issues of love affairs and all that, rather than the matters that relate to the municipality and running municipality and delivering services. The respect of the institutional arrangement, the oversight role that council has to do over the executive committee in the municipality, also in part respecting the administration in the municipality as well, because it has got the mandate to do certain things in terms of approved budgets and approved bylaws in the municipality. I mean, this thing that, you know, is councillors in one corner can just collude and then go and chase a municipal manager and do all sorts of things without even the executive committee knowing or whatever. I think it's becoming a problem, Deputy Minister. If we can find a way of the respect of the institutional arrangement in the municipalities, also in terms of the powers and authorities vested in specific arrangements, if we can find a way of just instilling that and jealously regarding that, because for now we are just crisscrossing. Crisscrossing is, you know, it's a group of councillors can go and try and influence administration. And, you know, it is a problem. It's a problem. I think that's what I just wanted to bring to the attention of the Deputy Minister. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Becker.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Minister, I'd like to plead with the Minister to use all his power and all the power of the ruling party to address this issue in those municipalities. I believe that there is no political responsibility, and I believe that political we can resolve the whole thing if you address it. Thank you.
On a positive note, Deputy Minister, the success story in Digatlong municipality in the Northern Cape. I had the opportunity to meet with the acting municipal manager, Advocate Robertson, who was deployed there by the provincial department of COCTA. And they forwarded to me their documentation, the success story of Digatlong. And it's plain and simple, do the basic things right. Have a MM, have a CFO, the relationship in the Troika, and qualified people to do the work. They had a zero bank balance, they were deep in debt, and they turned it around. Now, the point is, if they can do it, the rest can also try and do it. The same with Francis Barr District Municipality, also in the Northern Cape, had regional offices in Kimberley. So it can be done. And that's why this committee is so serious about the operations in municipalities. Because at the end of the day, in Macquarie Hills, it's the poor people that are suffering. Because the top leadership are having issues with each other. And we told them that. That's the implication of not taking decisions, and the people out there want to march. Over to you, Honourable Deputy Minister. I know there is no quick fix, I know that, but we must all work together to assist
yeah.
each other.
No, thank you, Chair President. Firstly, I should clarify my coming late. Actually, it wasn't a signal problem. The Minister phoned me last night and he said tomorrow. Now, when I got up, because I myself went to sleep in the early hours, not doing some party political work, it wasn't to do with cocktail. So when I got the message, I thought he meant Thursday at 9. So when I phoned him, he said, it's fine, I'll go there tomorrow. So he said, okay, good, because I got a double booking. So I said, fine. Then he rings me back a few minutes later. This is at about 10 kilometers from Christchurch and says, by the way, because I said, look, tomorrow I was going to see you in Swanee, right, Pretoria. So he says, you're talking about tomorrow? So I said, yeah, he says, no, I'm talking about today. I said, no, but I just got your message now. He says, no, I phoned you last night. So it wasn't so much a signal problem as a miscommunication. But anyway, I'm not late because you had another sitting. But firstly, the thing that strikes me about, I've seen your proposals there, excuse me, and the thing that strikes me about what you're saying is that it's so familiar. There's very little difference, in fact, if any at all, from what you're saying as Parliament and what we're saying as the executive. The issue really is what is our respective roles in addressing the problems. In fact, this is straight out of the State of Local Government report of 2009 and the local government turnaround strategy that derived from that report. And I know the province very well. I have been allocated by the previous minister to deal with the province together with him. And many times when he was unable to go or when he felt I should address some of them. So I've visited Northwest, I would say, Teck Muddy Bang 6 times, Naledi about 6 times in the last 2 years and so on and so on, Swaying about 3 times with your premier and new MEC and so on. So I think I've been to Northwest about 30 times, if not more, over the last 2.5 years that I've been deployed in this position. The thing that you have to understand from our point of view is that it's possibly the worst province. So you've got extreme challenges in the municipalities in Northwest. But in some or other measure, that applies to the country as a whole. We have not hidden it. Comrade Kalua made it very clear. This is where things are. So what you're saying to us is like a depressingly familiar picture. What it does suggest is that the local government turnaround strategy is not working to the extent it is. But let me pick up my main point would be, comrades, friends, is that the way this exchange is taking place, it's almost as if you're expecting national cocktail to... You said it's not wave a magic wand and solve the... All of us are in this boat together. In fact, in many senses, you have more power than we do. As Parliament, actually. One arm of Parliament. You see, we're dealing here with spheres of government. This is not like energy. Or it's not even housing. You know, it's not like a portfolio that the national sphere can... those are concurrent functions, but... COPTA is hamstrung by the provisions of the Constitution. There are many things we would like to do. We can't, because in the first instance, as you know better than me, since you're the NCOP, it's the provincial MEC and Department of Local Government, COPTA as it's now called, that has oversight responsibilities over municipalities. The national sphere can only intervene if the provincial government is not playing its role. And I think that's the point you're making. And that is specific in this case. That maybe what you're saying, and then it should be said explicitly, that the provincial department is not performing, therefore you feel the national department should more actively play a role in assisting the provincial department to assist the municipalities. That's the way the Constitution is. You passed the Constitution, I did. You know, it's scary. In other words, strictly speaking, my previous minister was hauled over the coals often, you know, in the public domain. There's nothing to hide. But why does COPTA go in there, into the municipalities? You must go through the provincial government. The opposition parties criticize us. It's all in the public domain. I'm not revealing any state secrets. Now, to some extent, we are seeking to address that issue. On the table, as it were, is the support, monitoring, and intervention bill, which is seeking to have a more integrated cooperative governance system, where the national government does play a more active role, even on Section 139 interventions. This bill will not require constitutional amendments. But as people know, December next year, the majority party is looking at further amendments to have a far more integrated cooperative governance system in which national and provincial government, as I think I previously said here, intervene far more actively in local government without eroding their powers or undermining their status as a distinct sphere of government. So I think we should be very clear that national government, COCTA in particular, is limited in what we can do. But working with Parliament, working with the provincial departments, working with actually communities, because they are very crucial in addressing some of these issues, we can together actually address these issues over time. So I will deal then with the specific issues. How much of time have I got? It's 20. What?
We've got
time
until 12:30.
Okay, now I'll move on, because you might have other questions. So the first thing I want to say is I think we need to work far more effectively together. I don't think there's any disagreement between us on what the challenges are. It's about maybe fine-tuning. We would like more of a response from you next time on LGTAS. Is it working? In what sense, if it is working, it's working? In what sense is it not working, and so on? I think there's nothing to hide. The officials from the Northwest Department here, they can speak. The sense that national COCTA that we have is that the department is unduly challenged. We agree with you, Comrade Chair, that to work effectively between provincial treasury and provincial COCTA is indispensable to address the issues of municipalities. Indeed, the Auditor General last year, when I put the question to him, why are some municipalities in some provinces doing significantly better than municipalities in other provinces? He said, A, it's where there's political leadership given to the management on finance issues. CFOs and MMs are answerable to a powerful mayor or member of the EXCO. And two, he said, it's where national, provincial treasury and provincial COCTA work closer together. So I entirely agree, and I think that's an important point in your report. And I'll take that back to the new minister as well. The next point to make is that it seems to me, I can't prescribe to you, Comrade Chair and members, that it's important to have the MECs here. When we have these inputs, the MECs for finance and COCTA should be here, together with the minister and or the deputy minister and the DG. So I'm not sure how these things get. This is a very bad period because the minister is caught up in the set 4-day or 3-day strategic session of the portfolio committee, which is a parliamentary structure. There's COP17 and there's a whole lot of issues, but I really think when you look at these reports, Comrade Chair, members, that you should actually have the provincial politicians here as well. Because really, they are the people who are most responsible to address these issues. We can nudge them, we can push them, but ultimately they must do more. We will assist them, obviously. We have our own challenges, as COCTA. There's nothing to hide about it. But we can certainly do more, and if that's your message, yes. We will, in fact, do more, and you can hold us to account. On the issues that you mentioned, Comrade, about so familiar. I know your province very well, actually. The one other thing I should say, and there's nothing to hide about this, this is COCTA's view. We've said it repeatedly, that we will not be able to address the problems in municipalities unless the majority party in particular, but all parties, are stronger, more stable, more cohesive, and less intrusive in local government affairs. I think, in fact, the previous minister thinks, and certainly I think the new minister will think once he comes to grips with the portfolio, that you can't address these issues unless the majority party in particular, its regional executive committees and provincial executive committees, operate properly. All the things you think are correct. Each time one faction of an REC comes into power, it wants to get rid of the municipal officials. Which is why, we went for the Municipal Systems Amendment Act. Now, once that act starts being effective, The regulations are before us right now. We've engaged with the unions, with CELGA, with academic experts and so on. The professionalization of the administration, I would imagine by the first quarter of next year, those regulations will kick in. It will stop these processes. You see, some people argue the national is trying to intervene too much and the provincial is trying to intervene too much in local government. But you see, the provision that says you can't appoint, dismiss, suspend municipal managers without alerting the MEC, who then alerts the national minister, is not to take away their powers. It's to actually ensure that political parties, whichever parties they are, all parties are doing this. My view is very clear. In this country, because the ANC is so overwhelming, obviously it will do it more. But the minority parties are also doing that. When they come to power, they kick out all the officials. Oh, they link to the other party and so on. So really, in my view, in the view of COCTA, it's happening in all political parties that are dominant in municipalities to some or other degree. But it's the majority party, obviously, that mainly has to address this issue. And we're making it very clear the provisions of the Act have to apply. The regulations will come into effect by April next year, hopefully, and that will mean that these things can't happen. You have to choose people for those jobs who have the necessary qualifications. The criteria set out in the regulations of our department and the regulations of the National Treasury that flow from the Municipal Finance Management Act. But we can have all the good regulations. We can have all the good laws and policies. At the end of the day, many of us are active in our branches, our RECs, our PECs. We have to not just play a role as members of parliament. We also have to play a role as active, advanced, progressive party activists that restrain the political parties from unduly interfering. We have said, Chairperson, it is correct in a democracy, especially where you have a list system, at least in this case 50%, for a party to exercise strategic and political oversight of municipalities. It can do this in many ways, Comrade Chair. Who chooses the candidates? The party structures. Who decides the manifesto? The party structures. The party has disciplinary processes where members of the councils do not abide by a party policy, decide in any C or PEC or RC. They can be hauled before those structures. That's how you exercise strategic and political oversight over a municipality. But you don't decide as an REC or a PEC that you're going to decide who the municipal CFO is going to be and tenders and so on. We haven't, there's nothing that we are saying here we haven't said before. And quite frankly, all that your report is doing is reinforcing the COCTA national positions up till now, and you are actually telling us that things are not working to the extent that they should. That is your main point. And as far as you think that, I think about Northwest, you are substantially correct. There's very little I can disagree with in this report. On the SIU investigations, yes, we have raised this repeatedly with the SIU. They are saying that every municipality is under investigation. They don't have the capacity. They are being financially challenged, as you know, now with this ESCOM challenge, which says that you can't raise money from the department or organ of state that is asking you to do the investigation. It's a conflict of interest. And they've got some rescue through National Treasury, but by no means what is adequate, okay? So the last time I spoke to the SIU was around shortly before the elections, but the Premier and the MEC, I met them recently, and they agreed that they will themselves speak to, I was in Rustenburg about 6 weeks ago, at the time I met the Premier and the MEC, they agreed that they will themselves now put some pressure on the SIU following the COSATU march there. The Section 139 interventions, you're absolutely right, this is the COCTA's view as well, that actually often, not always, often, far too often actually, in the majority of the cases probably, the administrator withdraws, and the provincial team with him withdraws, and the municipality slides back, as you said, back to square one. Now, what are we doing about this? This bill, the Support Monitoring Intervention Bill, is seeking to address that. Secondly, as COCTA, this is a matter I will raise with the new minister because we need to take this forward. It was a decision that the previous minister and I had opted on. It's to actually, we want to set up a database of effective administrators whom we can draw on and whom we can hold together with the provincial department to account. The province will allocate them because that's what the constitution says, but we will assist them. Because often the national cocktail has a broader horizon than a provincial MEC about options on making people available. So we are looking into that. I must confess, this decision was taken in about November last year. We started drawing up a database, but we haven't gone very far. In respect of Northwest, I know what you're hinting at. I think there's an agreement that some of the administrators deployed there may not have been the best or appropriate. We're aware that some of them have themselves been complicit in some of these irregularities in this cocktail. We apologize for that. Ultimately, the buck stops with us, the minister at the time and myself. We're the political heads in the DG. So we apologize for that. We've learned our lessons. It will not happen again. The new minister will be apprised about it, and I have no doubt that he will seek to avoid that happening. But insofar as you're hinting that it's in the public domain, and we feel that it's exaggerated, the claims about the irregularities of administrators and their failures, but certainly there's a germ of truth in that, and to the extent it's correct, we apologize. On the issue of what we do about Section 139, we'd like your advice, actually. The bill will come to Parliament hopefully early next year, and we would really like you to feed into it, you know, even before the bill is formally tabled. Maybe I can speak with the minister that we engage with you around the bill. It will be gazetted in any case, so, you know, there's no requirement for us to wait until the next version and comes in terms of the constitution. We have to gazette it. When we've got the bill ready, I think we start the process of engaging with you. So before the gazetted version is amended and brought back to Parliament, you've already had an input, because you are the people who have got considerable experience about Section 139. But we agree with you. On LGTS, no funding, I think you've answered that question. LGTS was never meant to be an extra pot of money. LGTS was always meant to be the reprioritization of existing funds. In fact, my friend, that's an excuse. There is no reason why 2 years later anybody should be arguing. It's almost 2 years, December 2nd, when Cabinet adopted LGTS, right? There is no reason why anybody should be saying we haven't got the money. It was never an issue of money. It was an issue of reprioritization of your existing resources and funds towards a clear strategic agenda of turning municipalities around. The minister has engaged with the department and myself, and I think is agreeing we're going to decide this at MINMAC early next year, because the previous minister and the acting minister agreed on this, that we would now put LGTS firmly on the agenda in the early part of the next year, probably after the State of Nation address. There is consideration being given, it hasn't been finalized yet. The last MINMAC proposed it, and we said that we would take it forward. Is that all the MECs, the minister, the deputy minister, the DG nationally, and all the provincial DGs and all the officials, will seek to visit as many municipalities as possible between, say, mid-February and shortly before the IDPs are finalized and the budgets adopted on the 1st of July. So the period from middle of February to late June is the period where the minister will lead this process of visiting as many municipalities as possible. There's an agreement in principle, but obviously we'll take it to the next MINMAC to take further. Last MINMAC agreed on it in principle. Now, there too, we could engage with Parliament. Now, even Dennis Bloom here, despite the party he comes from, and get you all to go out and visit the municipalities. So, on the police investigation that Dan speaks about, and the public protector, yes, proceed. The law must be conformed to. It must just be done. Thank you. On that one, the next one is Section 139. Again, I agree, there's nothing more to say. Firing officials, I've responded to that. The next questions were, I think the point you make about politicians, I think you're right, but it applies to all politicians. We all have a responsibility. The final set of questions are from the chairperson of comments, a good example and so on, of a municipality in the Northern Cape. I would really like information on that. I've not been to that municipality. So the secretary can ask the chairperson to email to sshoba, that's SSHOBA, at cocta.gov.za. I'm very keen to see the report. These good examples can't be crudely translated, but we should seek to draw from them. So I want to say that
We're keen to see that. I also agree entirely, as this cocktail as a whole, I think, that actually often municipalities work with people do the things, the basic things right. You know, there's no like rocket science required here, comrades, friends. No rocket science. Simple things. You know, like turning up on work on time. You know, staying till at least 5 p.m. if you started at 8 and, you know, you're taking an hour lunch. Unlike our ex-comrade here who turns up, comrade chair, at half past 11 to a meeting. But unlike Dennis Bloom here, they must be on time. So I was needling him, comrade chair. So anyway, what I think is that, comrade chair, is that we need your help, actually, as the NCOP. We really need your help. We need to work together. There's no difference for once, you know, one of the few, between the executive and parliament on the challenges we experience. But I do think also, lest we use Northwest as like a generic example, I think we should come here as COCTA and give you some of the very good examples of what's happening elsewhere in the country. There isn't a single one I can think of immediately in the Northwest, but there might be one or two. But Northwest is a special case. So why don't we work with you on Northwest? Why don't we even go together and do something about Northwest? You know, maybe spend a whole few days. We can send the COCTA officials nationally. If I'm available and choose a time, I'm happy to come. And let's see what we can do as Parliament, national, provincial government. We cannot, comrades and friends, we cannot continue like this. If local government remains as challenged as it is, the entire democracy is going to be extremely undermined. Really. And we cannot continue describing these things. Now, you have made various proposals. We will oversee this. I'll give this an official. I'll brief the minister tomorrow. We will do what we can. But it's for you as parliament to hold these people to account as well, with your provincial legislature committee on local government. That committee really, I don't know whether it's been given this report, that committee is the first port of call. It should actually call these municipalities. If I may suggest, because we really need parliament's help. I'm really pleading. You said you're pleading to me as the deputy minister. I'm pleading to you as an MP. Please help us to settle these issues. You see, what it seems to me reasonable is we need a concerted, coordinated, comprehensive assault on the irregularities and deficiencies of municipalities. So, hopefully, the provincial legislature can look at all these, the committee, look at all these, and over a period of maybe 2 months, hold each of these municipalities and say, have you done what the NCOP committee is, you know? And then shortly after that, we don't wait for another year and a half. Let's tackle, you know, you see, the problem with us in both in government and parliament, comrade chair, seems to me, we take on too many issues. And then we can't comprehensively and exhaustively deal with them. It seems to me more reasonable that you take on 10 issues and you resolve 4 of them. Then take on 25 and resolve 2 of them. Because there's too many issues. Let's work together on this. If you want to choose Northwest, you choose any other province. Let's exhaustively do what we can. As far as Section 139 interventions go, I want to finally say that decision is made by the province. They merely inform us, and then you know better than I do. The legal process comes to you as NCOP. The minister has to approve and so on. I agree with you. Section 139 is not your first port of call. It's your last resort. And even if you have a section 139, you can go for 139A, 1A, 1B, before you dissolve a municipality. Dissolution of a municipality should only occur in the last instance. And often dissolution doesn't solve the problems. For a province to think you can just intervene left, right, and center, presupposes that they have the capacity themselves as a provincial department and provincial government. And often they don't. So on Section 139, I think we really need a discussion with you. Let me engage with the minister tomorrow and tell him that when we, put it to him, he must decide that when we get the bill our text finalized, our consultation process, we come to you before we do the final version to Parliament. So in short, there is a substantial agreement between you and us. The only issue is what do we do about working together to address these issues exhaustively. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. I haven't heard your views on this, the issue relating to forensic reports, and then once they're out, there's reluctance to act. Even provinces don't, seems to be, that's the only thing that you didn't comment on. I don't know what it's delivering for.
No, it's very easy. I thought I did, the generic point I made, that where people have transgressed the law, whoever they are, they must actually be proceeded against. And to the extent Parliament has a role to draw this to the police's attention or to the SIU or to the public protector, good, and do it. Secondly, in respect of the specific issue you raise, give us examples of that. We will refer it to the MEC, or refer it to the MEC and the Minister simultaneously. That is happening, we are acutely aware of, not just in the province, Jefferson, that you come from. It's happening in many other municipalities too, that the evidence that is produced is not proceeded on. Reports are suppressed. Now, that is wrong. That is completely unacceptable. But I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not sure how the national and provincial sphere can intervene in these cases. We need some legal advice on that from the department. But in different cases, right, of municipalities doing the sort of thing that Chairperson, the acting chair, is referring to, there are different interventions one can make. In some cases, the report makes claims about people without evidence. So actually, a municipality can itself be subject to legal action were it to release in the public domain certain reports. If there is accusation about somebody or accusations about somebody that do not have substantial evidence, a person can actually take a counsel. A counselor could also take the counsel to court. That's what my understanding is. Let me say, I'm not a lawyer. But in other cases, it's a clear-cut case of sweeping things under the carpet, where it's possible, not just for government, but even for an individual progressive citizen or a ward committee or a structure in the communities to actually raise these issues. So can you give us, I would suggest, Chairperson, you write to the Minister and the MEC, and you can CC it to me because I'm at this committee meeting, and we will see what we can do about those cases. As for what I think, of course, I think it's wrong. That's a foregone conclusion. And even if I didn't think it's wrong, what do you think I'm going to say in the public domain? So, you know, I mean, it's just wrong. And we must act on it. And please, if you want us to assist, we can try to do what we can within the law.
Well, thanks, Honourable Deputy Minister. I am noting Honourable Bloom and Mashile. But just one point, Honourable Minister. You see, one of the biggest challenges, and I'm sure people would not want us to invoke some sections of the Constitution or this other act in terms of summoning people, it's quite a challenge these days. I don't know whether it's deliberate or what. Not only in Northwest, we saw it happening in Free State, it was the case in Eastern Cape, you find it in Limpopo when you're visiting them. The Department of Cooperative Governance in provinces, like even today, you see, the MEC is invited, as well as the MEC of Finance. There's only one apology from the MEC of Finance that she will not be able to attend yet, that I know. But there's a tendency of submitting apologies as if meetings are attended through these letters. Even if you go to the province, they don't go. Even if you call municipalities here and invite them, they don't come. They just send a white paper printed on and say, I'm able to come, and all those things. As if issues that we are discussing here are not important. But we know that during your min-max, they do attend. That's why we are finding it important to raise these things with you here, so that at your min-max, you are beginning to also raise these things that you are not cooperating with the people that are supposed to be assisting you, you see. It will be perhaps, I think perhaps we should take that route of working with yourself insofar as also
having to go with you, but in to these particular provinces and identify one or two municipalities that we can concentrate on and say, this is what needs to happen during this particular period. We'll be observing and get regular feedback. But out of our visits as the Committee of Finance in the NCOP, what we usually do on the very last day of our week-long meetings in those particular provinces, we would request, we would tell them that COPTA National, because we invite all the role players, COPTA National, National Treasury, ESCOM, everybody. It's like a mass meeting, but precisely to try to find ways and solutions to help municipalities. We will always leave the processes in the hands of provincial and national COPTA to work together and national treasury to say, we expect you to formulate a team that will then work on this, will also supply you with our report, work on these things, and then after a certain period, we'll call you to come and account. You would expect such a task team to be driven and formed by provincial COCTA, or at best national to facilitate it to be established. But in none of these promises, they ever established that. You see? Because, for an example, when you go for a follow-up, the very first day we'll say this is a day for provincial COCTA and provincial treasury to tell us about progress made insofar as issues that we raised are concerned. At best, you'll get progress reports from Water Affairs, ESCOM, and them, and Treasury. Come to COCTA as a provincial department, both national and provincial, because they're always the zero that you get. You see? So that is the biggest challenge. We understand your limitations, but at the same time, where we are saying we are going to help you do 1, 2, 3, 4, and we agree, we expect at least that such things be acted upon, and because it's a simple point of just monitoring and helping those along their decisions that we have taken. We respect the powers of municipalities. We know the limitations. Even us as parliament, we surely have certain limitations. There are certain things that we can't even do. Hence, we want to work together as with all the spheres of government. But really, my experience is that we don't get equal support and commitment from provincial departments of cooperative governance. You see. So that is one area that would require that perhaps in your min-max, you begin to emphasize. You will always get concrete reports from provincial treasuries. Between now and when you were here, these were the issues that relate to us. This is what we have done. And municipalities will confirm that, no, we are working very closely with provincial treasury. But when it comes to COCTA, whoa, disaster. You see. So we are really now ending up moving in cycles. I agree with you. All the things that you have raised here are well captured in many of your reports. There are new things. We are like repeating one thing over and over, over and over. But we are saying it's about time now that we stop this cycle and move and make progress in terms of these municipalities. Otherwise, we must just accept that there's nothing that can be done and we are defeated. And we are not even about to begin saying that. We still believe that we can still turn things around. Make noise about those municipalities that are doing things right as one way of also motivating them. But I agree fully with you. A lot of problems can be resolved if our political parties as well can play ball. Because some of these things that are happening in these municipalities, you could see that from the Bloom, you were late. In fact, let me give Mashile first. You'll follow. You're not late. You are early for the meeting. I know you went out, but you just came in as we are presenting. Mashile has got a follow-up. Yours might be a new thing. Okay, then I've ruled. Listen, Honorable Bloom, I'm sharing here. Honorable Mashile, and then you follow. I'm abusing my power, yes. Mashile, can you speak?
My hand was up before you.
Bloom, Mashile, can you speak?
No.
Bloom must accept also that there is seniority issues here that comes in.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're hosting that.
You know, it's Honorable Chair, I think the point that I wanted to raise, you have in passing raised it, which I just wanted to make it much more clear, is that some of the officials in COGTA at province level, they are just not on top of their issues when it comes to the municipalities. You really cannot get responses of a person that looks like he or she knows exactly what's happening. You really don't have that feel. And I really think that probably they need to be activated. I don't know how. And also taking action, I think, Deputy Minister, on some of the officials in COGTA that really misrepresent the department and misrepresent government. I'll just simply table one of such incidents. I think it's last week Friday or so, where Honorable Bloom was involved in Free State, where there was a question about a municipal official who used the card of the municipality to actually buy his or her own things. And an official from Cogdan then in the media said, no, that's not a problem. We'll just recoup the money from this municipal official. I mean, surely that can't be correct. There is no way that municipal finances can be used as advances of, you know, sort of officials for their personal things. But really, that was a response from a provincial official of COGTA who really said in the media that that's not a problem. We will just simply go and recoup, we'll just pay back. And such kind of officials really misrepresent the department and misrepresent government and actually create problems, you know, to the constituencies. That we have got officials that simply just use government funds for their own, and then if they are caught, they will pay. The problems that will arise, if they are not caught, what happens? You see. Thanks, sir.
Any other questions? Honorable Bloom.
No, Jefferson, thank you very much. Let me start with seniority. I'm more senior than all of you who are sitting here in this room. More senior. The Deputy Minister can attest to that. That is the first one. The second one is that Deputy Minister, some of us are not so lucky as you. I'm from 3 meetings already since this morning. You are standing, you are waking up very late in the morning, have your breakfast and whatever. So I'm early for the chairperson, no. Now, let me come to this one. You know, Chairperson, the Deputy Minister was a member of Parliament, and a chairperson, and a chairperson of the very same local government committee. I am surprised that the minister is crying from that side to here, and members from this side crying back to him. I don't understand, really. Now, the answer to this problem is, you must bite. These people who are stealing taxpayers' money must be arrested. Don't shift a head of the special investigating unit who is doing very good at present and shift him to another department, because Willy Hofmeyr was doing very good. You know that. All of us know. Now, he is asset forfeiture unit, getting work from Judge Heath back to him. I am saying we must, all of us, must bite. These criminals, you get a municipal manager stealing 2 million rand. He's gone. They are bringing in somebody else. He's also eating. He's gone. No action at all. No punishment. He's not going to jail. Nothing. I am saying that we must... Let us not cry. Let us put foot down and say, criminal, you belong to jail, finish and last.
Any other questions? Although, Deputy Minister, you can make your input on this.
Quickly, firstly, I think that SELGO should also be here, the South African Local Government Association, because they play a crucial role. And I think the provincial structure of SELGO should also be here, the Northwest, in this case, provincial structure of SELGO. Secondly, I think you're aware that we set up what we call provincial support units of COCTA, which are meant to work closely with the provinces to assist them to deal with municipalities. And I think we should also ensure in future that a representative of the provincial support unit from the respective provinces here, their job is to monitor on the ground and brief the minister and keep him abreast of what's happening. Thirdly, I think that where provincial departments don't cooperate, I think the choice is also to raise it with the premier. But as you well know, in terms of the constitution, there's very limited scope we have as national COCTA to do something about provincial COCTA, because we have three spheres of government. So what we can do is what the comrade was suggesting, or the member was suggesting, is that we raise this at MINMAC. So I will raise this thing. I'll brief the minister tomorrow, but I'll raise it that we would be very grateful if provincial MECs cooperated with Parliament. We can raise it at MINMAC, and I would like a letter from your chairperson to the minister, CC to me, so that we can raise it with them. We can even distribute the letter at the MINMAC, the first MINMAC for next year. So in other words, a lot of the questions you're raising about provincial government, you actually have more oversight powers than we do as national government, as NCOP, because you, that's your role. So I think we're prepared to play our role. About the MEC in the province, if you have issues, comrade, Chairperson, can you raise it? Send it to us, we will, and CC it to him, we will raise it with him. You saying that the Bashila, that the department's weak in the province. I think they themselves will, in their more open moments, admit they've got their challenges, and certainly we think. There's a particular history there where, I think you might be aware, for a while, the MEC for local government, COCTA, he was, his local government side was moved to the Premier's office, and he was just the Minister, MEC for Traditional Affairs. And that has since recently been changed, and we have a new MEC. So one also has to be a bit understanding. This is a new MEC. He came in, I think, in the early part of this year. So he's also finding his feet. We need to activate the provinces. I mean, I agree, but, you know, there are constitutional constraints to what we can do, but as NCOP, you can do far more. But at MINMAC, we'll raise that issue. We can't take, as you well know, officials from the provincial COCTA. We can't take action against them, A, because the employer is the provincial department, and B, the whole lot of labor relations issue. But can you, Chairperson, write to us in regard to this? We will ask the MEC to answer. How can a provincial official say it doesn't really matter as long as the person returns the money? It overlaps with what MP Bloom is saying, right? So please give us the information and we will act on this. Mr. Bloom, you were actually late. When you're saying we're crying, not at all. We're actually doing the reverse. We're saying we need to work together. The executive, Parliament, civil society, the ward committees and other community structures, the provincial legislature and the provincial departments. So we're not crying. We're actually setting out a very concerted, very comprehensive strategy on what to do. Both of us, executive and Parliament, saying the same thing. We cannot continue to lament, as the acting chair was saying a moment ago. We can't lament. We have to do something about this thing. So we're not crying. We entirely agree that action should be taken against people who are corrupt. But corruption is not the only challenge we have in municipalities, as you know very well. It's merely a symptom of a broader set of crises we have.
municipalities are not functioning in terms of community participation. Ward committees are not working the way they should. Budgetary processes, IDP forums are not working the way they should. So in the first instance, the communities out there are not playing the role that the law provides for in the Municipal Systems Act and in other legislation, partly because the municipalities have closed the space. So I think really a crucial component of rescuing municipalities and indispensable part of the Algiers TAS is public participation. So as for the examples of corruption, it's necessary to point out that the SIU investigations in the province were initiated by National Corruptor in consultation with the Premier at the time. So we, the previous minister and the Premier, actually initiated this process and took it to the President to sign the proclamation. And I think, as I remember it, we had one single proclamation for the whole province. Every municipality is under investigation. You know, of course, that cases are being proceeded in the court. But we were not here, and it's not appropriate for us to understand you in three and four committees, Dennis, obviously. I'm just teasing you. But the fact is that, you know, we really are having a problem. The SIU says they do not have capacity. It's too much that they have to do in that one province, let alone other municipalities. Even Eteguini is under investigation, as well run as it is, and so on. Sometimes, quite frankly, Chairperson, some of these investigations are political in complexion, meaning the basis that's given to the SIU sounds, on paper, it's technically and legally necessary to have an investigation. But when you look beyond it, it's once again the point we made earlier. It's the factionalization of political parties and the settling of scores. I mean, it is important to act against corruption. But it's also important to recognize that sometimes people marginalize their adversaries by smearing them. There are some very innocent people whose families have been destroyed just by accusations and media exposure. And the media never adequately, ultimately, makes up for these allegations. And they themselves, unwittingly or sometimes maybe wittingly, play a role in smearing people who are innocent. So, yes, we must act against corruption. But it can hardly be said, especially under this new administration since 2009, that there hasn't been a determined effort to get municipalities investigated. There are more SIU investigations in municipalities now, Chairperson, than ever there have been. But clearly the problem is bigger than what we are able to deal with at the moment. And we have to think of creative ways of accelerating the fight against corruption.
Any other questions? Honorable Chani.
No, there is not a question. Just a point that I'm just picking it up as the minister is talking there. The support unit you have in Northwest, they reported during our visit that they were not properly introduced in that province, and as a result, they are being marginalized. There's no cooperation at all. And it's a point that I also raised with Errol Africa that it needs to be attended because, I mean, their being there is much as they are not there because nobody recognizes them, nobody is cooperating with them. They are left to get information on their own and sometimes there are serious limitations and constraints. So it's a point that I think we need to look into. Sure. Thank you.
No, we're aware of that. In fact, Minister Mthethwa was briefed on that. The DG was mandated. I was supposed to also attend it, but the DG is mandated to actually facilitate a meeting. I had several discussions with the Premier as well about this matter. And frankly, there are sometimes politics in a province, either politics of the government or the majority party, that undermines this relationship. Some people have constitutional uneasiness about it. Why should a national department have a unit in the provinces when you already have a provincial MEC and a provincial department? So we've been trying to manage that process for about 8 months now. But yes, you're right, we have to do more, and I'll certainly raise it at Elroy tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Deputy Minister. Any other questions? None. Thank you, Minister. Then you are released to go back to Franschhoek and join the Strat plan. But thank you for your availability and your commitment that we all work together and get solutions. That is also the objective of this committee. Thank you very much. Yes. All the members, do you want a comfort break?
No, no, Chair. I was just saying, just for record, the report that is being given to the minister right now is still a draft. So a final report, once that draft is picked up, will be sent to you.
We're going to consider this report today, but that will formally be given to you.
Chairperson, can I suggest, which you're probably going to do anyway, that you write formally to the minister, the DG, send him a copy, and myself. And then we will act on it. And you can always contact me, you know, to raise things further. Okay, thank you.
We'll do so. Thank you. You need a comfort break? Can we go on?
Let's finalize.
Yes. Honourable members, Honourable Bloom, I interacted with the Minister of Finance. The only time the Minister is available to interact with this committee with him is tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock. There is no other time. On the issues raised specific by the Honourable Mashiri. Now, we left the meeting.
So,
Honourable Chani?
Whilst he's still outside, may I suggest that we deal with the report and sign off on this matter as the last point.
Okay.
And if you agree, Chair, may I zoom straight to the report?
Sorry?
With your permission, can I reflect on the report?
Yes, yes, please.
Okay.
We're still dealing with the Northwest report.
Yeah, Chair, I only had an opportunity to... I know that the report was circulated yesterday and we expected to submit comments yesterday. But unfortunately, I had an opportunity to go through the report now. Now, I don't know, but what I found in the report... The report is very thin in terms of its summary in municipalities, submission of municipalities. In most instances, it is only concentrated on revenue collection and the debt and all those things. But it does not specify major challenges that each municipality is concerned. And you only begin to get that as you go to recommendations. You see. And my understanding has always been that whatever that you find or under your observation or is your recommendation should be able to be traced elsewhere in the report. So I'm saying there's some work that the secretary still have to do in terms of making sure that in terms of submission of those municipalities, the challenges that we have picked up during our interaction with them and the weaknesses are properly reflected so that we are able to read the recommendations together with the content of the report itself. I mean, you would see, you go through all of them, Summary, but only reflecting on the monetary elements of their presentation. And then, yeah, that is one point that affects the entire report. I'm not sure what is the views of the matter. But if you go to, then I've got also specifics with regard to all those points under recommendations, but perhaps let me not venture into that first, because if there's an agreement that the secretary will still have to do some additions
in terms of giving specific challenges under each municipality. Because the report as it is, it will be like the only challenge that each municipality have is around issues of collection and revenue sources and revenue, I mean debtors and creditors. But then when you go to the recommendation, you find a different picture. So if there is an agreement on that understanding, then I can give some of these points that I've made here. I think it's about 10 points in terms of the recommendations back to the secretary so that in his reworked report, those things are included. Thank you, Chair.
I want to get some clarity for myself. Did honourable members work through the report and made their notes on this? Otherwise, we table this report, that you go back and do your homework, and we schedule another meeting to deal with this report. Honourable Bloom?
I will support that, Chair, to take that route, and we come back again to interact with the report.
Honourable Leaf?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's kind of half the answer, because what Honourable Chan is saying is that the Secretary would elaborate on each municipality. Is that also part of it? Yes.
That is part of it, what the Secretary will do, because that is a second draft that will come back to the members and then take it through the motions. So there's additional work to be done by the Secretariat. I put it to the committee. Yes, then we send the Secretariat back to redo the report and redistribute it to us, and that we see when we can schedule a meeting to deal then with the Northwest report. Because next week we're entering our last few days at the NCLP. So that deals then with the report on the members, and other additions that you want to make, please forward that then to the Secretariat, please. That brings us to the minutes. There's two sets of minutes that we have to deal with, honourable members. It was distributed to the members? Yes. The first set is the meeting of the 22nd of November, where we got a briefing on the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill and the Taxation Laws Second Amendment Bill, and the consideration of the report and other minutes that we dealt with. I put to you page 1. Albert Chani.
Chair, I'm sure I left my minutes there by you, but page 1, if this is the minutes of the 22nd, under apologies, you'll see under apologies, it is recorded 3 apologies. But in the paragraph that talk about apologies, it says 2 apologies were tabled and adopted. But when you check that table that says people who apologize, it's actually 3 people. So, yeah.
We will correct that. Anyone else on page 1? Page 2.
Please go let me see the back, please.
Page 2. Page 3. I put the minutes to the committee. Can move in a second.
Chair, on the minutes of the 22nd, I have got. There's a sentence that relates to a meeting between us and the SARS or whatever to discuss members' traveling allowance. I'm sorry, I'm taking from my notes here. I think the decision was broader than just members'. Traveling allowance, it had to do with us going to engage them around tax implications on members arising out of these allowances that we get. Because you remember the issue there was that the taxing system, particularly when it comes to members, does not take into consideration the kind of work that we do as politicians, particularly on those allowances, this public office bearers allowance and the car things and all those things. So the way it's been captured is only limited to the travel allowance. I did not understand it to be specifically travel allowance, but it was tax in those proteins. I don't have a proper way to...
We captured just as you have said it now in the meeting. Anyone else on the minutes? Without corrections? Honorable Chani?
I move, Chair.
There's a mover for the adoption, a seconder? To the minutes of the 23rd of November, when we met with the municipalities from Northwest. I put to you page 1. Just on page 1, Honorable S.D. Monsisi, ANC Gauteng. Just turn it around. That is Gauteng ANC, that it is in sequence with the with what is at the top. Page 1, page 2. Yeah. Of the machine.
I'm not really sure because there were some other times that one has not been around. But the content has been reduced too much to the bone that this minister does not actually serve any purpose. I'm not sure if the item could record something that one can understand what the we were about, and because at the moment, if you just pick up this minute. If you just pick up this minute, you will not have a picture, let alone that much of the content will be in a report that we produce. But if you just pick up this set of minutes, they are too skinny. I'm not sure whether there is any improvement, but not necessarily to rewrite the report here or rewrite the whole discussion. But just simply to have a picture of what was happening in there, in a small way. I just have the feel for the next coming minutes, yeah. Not necessarily for this one to be tackled.
Lumen Ongochani.
Thanks, Chair. No, Chan is senior than me, that's why I'm looking at him. Chairperson, that's exactly what I wanted to... You see, it's not only for us this minute, but for other people also, when they get this minute in their hands, they don't know. Maybe it's going into, maybe that's the style that the committee have decided upon. But if you are saying that the content will go into the report, then it's something else. But I also want to ask clarity on 5.4, Chairperson, on page 3. Was it that the deputy minister have presented now? Now I want to is there any explanation why the Northwest MEC and finance is not present at the meeting? Thank you.
Yes, Honourable Bloom. When we started the meeting, I read out the apologies. There was one apology from the MEC for local government in the Northwest. He phoned me last night, then I told him that he must then send the MEC for Finance. We didn't receive any apology from the MEC for Finance on the mob in the Northwest, and that is the factual situation. Albert Chani?
No, Chair, thanks. Just a reminder that the format that is being followed here is as per our previous decision, where we said the minutes should be this thing, and then the report should capture the Jews and everything and the bones and everything. I'm just reminding Honorable Mashile and others, and on that note, I move for adoption of the minister.
There's a mover for adoption with the amendments. A seconder on the list, thank you very much. That deals with the minutes. Then, honorable members, coming back to the issue of the tax administration bill. I interacted with the minister. I received a note that he wants to speak to me regarding our request that the committee say that he must be present to give some clarity. I said I will put it to the committee. The honorable minister is available tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, for 30 minutes. Honorable Chani?
No, Chair, I don't know. I take note of the availability of the minister. It's just a short notice. Well, I understand perhaps he's doing that so that we can find finality to this particular matter. But I was just wondering if after your engagement with Honorable Mashile on this matter, on the sidelines, he has not reconsidered, so that if there is any reconsideration, we can then adopt a report on this thing once and for all.
I mentioned the concerns raised at the previous meeting that was in September, concerns and actually questions raised by the honorable members, and that's how we started the meeting. This was also adopted by the Standing Committee for Finance in the National Assembly, as is. And they also raised their concerns that is correct. Honorable Chani?
Sorry, Chair. The point I'm raising relates to your engagement with Honorable Masile after your discussion with the minister. That's why I'm asking if he has not reconsidered. Based on that, I'm not sure if I'm correct that you have interacted with him.
I'll send the Honorable Mashile a note. Mashile, because I must interact immediately with the minister. He's got to make arrangements to get here and must go back again to Pretoria.
No, Chair, it is unfortunate that Honorable Tano wants side meetings. Because we have not had side meetings, sir, but I've just read the note, Chair. Although is that I really don't know how I'm going to respond to that. But I think if he has got more clarity on the matter, I think it will be nice to have him, and let's have clarity on these issues. Thanks.
Honorable Bloom.
Chairperson, I was not here and I don't know the issue here, but I'm having a proposal. If it is possible, the concern that Comrade Mashile is having. Can the minister put it on paper and forward it to the committee? Because you are saying it's half an hour meeting, and he must go back again. Let us consider that maybe the minister must give clarity on a paper. That's my proposal.
See, honourable members, the tax administration bill, the tax laws amendment bills form actually a package, because this is the administrative part of the bills we adopted yesterday in the NCP. This is the administration of that. That was the briefing we got initially. I saw a hand on the list.
Chairman, I was actually going to ask that very question, and so you've answered my question. I understood that the tax administration bill was a replacement for a part of the Income Tax Act, and then the yesterday's whatever they were called were the implementation of changes to taxation rates and so on. So they could be implemented in terms of the existing act, but I'm obviously wrong. You're saying they can't be, so that's fine.
Well, I spoke to the minister about this issue, and that was his response to me when I went out of the meeting to get clarity on this. I need some direction, honourable members.
Chair, I've put a proposal. Yeah, I've put a proposal, and let's hear, is there a counter proposal or is there a second on that?
There's a proposal on the table by Honourable Bloom that the minister respond in writing to the issues raised, specific by the Honourable Mashile. The proposal by Honourable Bloom is that the issues raised by Honourable Mashile be forwarded to the minister and he respond in writing. Members, this is not my meeting, this is our meeting, so you must assist me in guidance here.
Chair, I'm really not sure about the constraints of time that we may be having. I'm really not sure in terms of processing the legislation. But like as I said before, if the consequence will be scuttling the process of getting some of this crucial legislation, one would be prepared to withdraw the proposal. But we may pursue these explanations within the next 12 months and actually find each other whether we really mean what we are passing. I think that is the intention. If there is time, it would have been better really to really have some engagement, because there are principal issues that we're trying really to grapple with, which are at stake, but it won't be a train smash for the next 12 months or so. If there is problem, challenges of time. But if there is no challenges of time, I mean, we can have a date with the minister and then understand, and you see, as long as we agree that the thing goes past, we approve. But with the minister fully aware that maybe we have got a consensus that this must be done in this particular manner, then we can expect the amendments to be made as we move forward for the next 12 months. The problem is that we must make the point home if we are in agreement that this is this principle has been undermined and it needs to be corrected. Then it is fine. Thanks.
Ongutani, you want to say something?
No, sir, in the sake of time, I mean, in light of what, if I understood him, in light of what Honorable Mashile is saying, which I also agree with, I was just checking if we do form a quorum to then move for the adoption of the report.
We're just making it.
So we move then for the adoption of that report.
Honorable Chani is moving for the adoption of the report with the rider that the minister must clarify issues raised by the committee. And when the report is tabled in the House, the chairperson will also sensitize the issues raised in the committee meeting. Honorable Becker? Sensitized and seconded. Thank you, Honorable Becker. Then we adopt the report. I'm going to read it to the Honorable Members that it is on record. Report of the Select Committee on Finance on the Tax Administration Bill B11B 2011, National Assembly, Section 75, dated 30 November 2011. The Select Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Tax Administration Bill B11B of 2011, National Assembly, Section 75, referred to it and classified by the JTM as a Section 75 bill, reports the bill without amendments. I put it to the committee that the bill be adopted.
Agreed.
Honorable Lees.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make the point that Honorable Becker and I haven't developed a severe headache and left the chamber at this point.
Well, you are very well present. There's, I can't see any headaches. I've got Grandpa for you to assist you. Thank you, Honourable Members. Then this report is adopted. That concludes the business of the day. We will inform the Honourable Members of the meeting to consider the report on the Northwest Municipalities. I don't know if it's possible next week. We'll have to look at that. But with that, this meeting then stands adjourned. Thank you for your participation.